Welcome to Done and Done. I'm Alicia, your hostess on this podcast journey exploring and connecting the universe of Dominic Dunn. Thank you for joining me today for this surprise episode as we continue to swim with the swans this week, but we are leaving the Capote versus the Swans feud series behind. This episode is going to be the first of three to unpack the story of the real feud. That is the battle between Truman Capote and Gore Vidal. It's epic. It's super epic. So many connected bits. The full understanding of the feud between Gore Vidal and Truman Capote, understanding that saga makes a way bigger impact when you have the whole entire sordid story. All Truman Capote really does is get involved in the affairs of a family that he really had no business to talk about in the first place, but Truman Capote has all the inside scoop within the family as Truman Capote and dear Princess Lee Radziwill have been bosom friends since the late 1950s. They do not stay that way by the late 1970s when Truman Capote will talk to Playgirl magazine about a scandalous story that happened all the way back at the White House in 1962. Truman talks about this particular story many, many moons later, which begins the whole lawsuit mess with Gore Vidal that endures through the late 70s and even up to and after Capote's death. Before we get to the feud, we have a little investigating to do. Gore Vidal and Lee Radziwill are step-siblings. They do not share the same mother or father, but they are related in the family tree through Hugh D. Auchincloss. Gore's mother, Nina Gore Vidal, and Lee's mother, Janet Lee Bouvier, are the second and third wives, respectively, of Hugh D. Auchincloss. Gore, Lee, and, by association, Jacqueline Kennedy all share a stepfather. That's Hugh D. Auchincloss. In this origin story episode, the first of our three in this arc, I'm going to give you a little bit of a prologue about our mothers involved here. I want to talk about how Gore and Lee and that whole history connects before we make it to Lee Radziwill in the next episode, and then finally, Truman's complicated rivalry relationship and feud with Gore Vidal. Before we begin today's episode, I do have a few fine folks to thank our very newest supporters over at patreon.com/doneanddone. Big thanks to Surfer Girl and Amy S. Y'all are simply amazing. Thank you, thank you. Big love to you and all of our sustaining supporters, getting early and ad-free episodes and weekly Not Done Yet bonus episodes too. So grateful to y'all and to you for joining today as we get into the mothers, Nina and Janet. Let's investigate. Oh my, oh mothers, here we're getting into the origin story. We have a continuous through line among all of our episodes in Done and Done, where the same people in the same towns keep popping up. And there's really only about one degree of separation between all of them. We're going to begin today's story with Gore Vidal's mother. Gore Vidal, famous writer, raconteur. We're going to get into all of him. But in order to get to him, we need a mom. There is a layer to the Gore and Truman Capote feud, which makes their relationship, the relationship between the two writers, even more complicated. We have talked about Truman Capote's mother, Lily Mae Falk, spoiled, impetuous, beautiful. Gore Vidal's mother, Nina, kind of the same way. Both Lily Mae, who goes by Nina when she moves to New York, and Gore's mother, Nina, really similar similarities along with the spoiled and impetuous and beautiful. On the flip side of that, both Nina Gore and Lily Mae Falk, Nina Capote, each have their own demons with alcohol and scandalous living. Nina Gore really is something else. Let's meet her. Nina Gore was born July 25th, 1903. Nina comes into the world as the daughter of U.S. Senator Thomas Gore, who represented the state of Oklahoma. Little Nina's mother, her mother was also named Nina. Nina Sr. in this case was the daughter of a Texas plantation owner. Thomas Gore and Nina Sr. were married in 1900, leaving Nina to come along in 1903. Nina Jr. does have a younger brother, Thomas, who was born in 1910. Nina Gore will marry for the very first time in 1922, when she was a very young 19 years old. Nina's first husband is a man named Eugene Vidal. He goes by Gene. Gene was a commercial aviation pioneer. Gene Vidal, kind of a big deal. He had competed in the decathlon at the 1920 Antwerp Olympics. Gene is a little bit older than his new bride, Nina. He's about 7 years older. At the time of their wedding in 1922, Gene was in the Army, stationed at Fort Still, where the newlyweds will live after the wedding. Nina, spoiled, impetuous, beautiful daughter of a senator and a distinguished, wealthy mom. It turns out Nina doesn't really love being an Army wife too much. Living on an Army base wasn't exactly glamorous or exciting, and that life doesn't suit Nina really at all. Perhaps Nina, in marrying Gene, just wanted to get out of the house. Her father, Senator Gore, had lost his eyesight early in life, and not only is he blind, but he's also really, really grumpy to be around. Nina marries Gene, gonna grow up and be her own big thing, but marriage turns out to be not exactly what Nina thought it would be. She does marry an impressive man, though. Gene Vidal would go on to be one of the first aeronautics instructors at West Point. It was at West Point where Gene and Nina welcomed their son, Gore Vidal, into the world in 1925. Gore Vidal goes on to be a famed author, intellectual, and society figure, mostly known for his controversial books and his personality, and for our purposes, his feud with Truman Capote. Nina and Gene, with baby, would move back to Washington after their time at West Point, where Gene Vidal would end up becoming an executive at Transcontinental Air Transport. This is TWA. He'll work for Eastern Airlines and Northeast Airlines as well. It is not marital bliss for Gene and Nina. There are a number of reasons why this marriage is not working so well. Primarily, the first one being Nina's really difficult personality, her immense ego, and her unpredictable behavior, which her son Gore would openly discuss later in his life. Gore's mother Nina was beautiful and glamorous, but she really didn't have too much interest, if any at all, in being a mother. In fact, Gore Vidal later said of Nina, "We rarely got into a conversation. It was pointless. She didn't see me. I wished I didn't see her." As mentioned, Nina also had some mental health issues and struggled with alcoholism. Her son Gore calls her a quote-unquote alcoholic who was certifiably insane. In another interview, Gore calls his mother, quote-unquote, a drunk and a monster. In his memoir, Palimpsest, he wrote of his mother, Nina. She confessed that rage made her orgasmic. I forgot to ask her if sex ever did. Oh, so much is scooped into our childhoods. One other line from Gore here. "I got one good thing from Nina. I would never marry. Ever. And they said, you'll get to the White House if you have a wife and 5 children, and all I had to do was think of my mother, and nope, nope, no way." True, Gore Vidal never did marry. He certainly did get that from Nina. So, she's a little complicated. Got a few things going on, but that's not the only reason that the Gene and Nina marriage is going badly. There's another factor. That other factor is both parties frequently engage in affairs. Gene Vidal was in a romantic relationship with Amelia Earhart. They worked together at TWA, and they will continue until her disappearance in 1937. Gene is not the only one having an affair, though. Nina is having an on-and-off affair with Clark Gable. Clark Gable is not the only man that Nina would dally about with. Nina would often openly brag about her sexual partners and adventures, and there were many of them. But Nina and Clark Gable on and off for many years, this particular romantic liaison gets Nina connected into the Hollywood movie-making community. This is going to be really, really helpful to her son, Gore Vidal, in future years, who grows up around all of it. More to come on that. It is on May 21st, 1935, that the New York Times ran an article reporting that Nina Gore Vidal had headed to Reno. Why is that? You know, it's to get a divorce. This article reads, Washington Post quotes husband as uninformed on her trip. The Washington Post says that Mrs. Eugene Vidal, wife of the chief of the Commerce Department's Bureau of Aeronautics, is now en route to Reno, but quotes Mr. Vidal as having said that he did not know whether or not a divorce was the object of her trip. The article continues to point out that the couple had been married now for 13 years and shared one son together. It is July 3, 1935, that same year, that the New York Times reports that Nina Gore Vidal had requested a divorce in Reno, Nevada. Nina has stated cruelty as the grounds for her divorce. This particular article reads, asked concerning reports that the Washington matron intends to marry Hugh D. Auchincloss, Washington investment banker, following her expected divorce, the attorney said, I am personally satisfied she has no intention to immediately remarry. However, helpfully, the article also includes the fact that, in fact, Hugh D. Auchincloss had visited Mrs. Vidal in Reno just the previous week, where she was living on a secluded dude ranch for the past 6 weeks in order to get her divorce. The two, Nina and Hugh, apparently went to Lake Tahoe, where they were the guest of his sister and brother-in-law. 1935, big year, big year. It was not long after that, this date is October 8, 1935, that the New York Times reported on Hugh D. Auchincloss's second marriage. This article is titled, Hugh Auchincloss Marries in Capital, Takes Mrs. Nina Gore Vidal, Daughter of Senator Gore, as Bride in Home Wedding. The article reads in part, Mrs. Vidal wore a gray velvet gown and a cluster of orchids. She was unattended. Chauncey Parker was the best man. Mr. Auchincloss and his bride will make their home on his estate at McLean, Virginia. The marriage is the culmination of a romance first reported when Mrs. Vidal left Washington last May for Reno, where she was divorced on July 3rd from Mr. Vidal, to whom she was married 13 years ago. Nina and Hugh do marry in 1935. Their daughter, Nina Gore Auchincloss, was born on January 10, 1937. A son comes later, Thomas Gore Auchincloss, born in 1939. Now, Gore Vidal has two step-siblings, and his mother is married into the Auchincloss family. This begins another layer of our story. Now's a great time to take a break. Back in just a moment.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Lauren, we are sisters.
That's true.
And we host a celebrity-obsessed podcast called Pop Apologists.
We also love Taylor Swift. Chandler, how are you managing to cope while we await Taylor's new album?
Look, I want to be put into a medically induced coma and wake up on April 19th, but I'm not sure my insurance is going to cover it.
Join us on our pop culture podcast, Pop Apologists, where we will be dishing on all things celebrity news and deep diving every word and note of Taylor's new album.
Pop Apologists.
Pop Apologists.
I guess you could say Nina and Hugh sitting in a tree. Two children from this marriage, a son and a daughter. However, it's not exactly quite like that. Gore Vidal reveals much in his recollections of how this marriage actually started. This is from his memoir. Gore Vidal will reveal, Nina had made an informal prenuptial agreement with Hudie. She would marry him in order to bring glamour. He had a passion for senators into his life and to be a good stepmother to his forlorn child. But since she did not care for him that way, theirs would be a marriage blanc. Crafty Hudie agreed. Then he made a formal prenuptial agreement that she be given a fixed income for life and never anything more. Apparently, he had to pay way too much to Nina's predecessor, a colorful Russian lady who had been accidentally scalped by an airplane propeller. Delirious in the hospital, she spoke of the true love of her life, whose name was not Hudie. When she recovered, Hudie divorced her, and she married her true lover and loved happily ever after, something poor Hudie did not. Gore Vidal describes Hugh Auchincloss as stealing his mother away from the man she was in love with and expected to marry. Who is this man? We have heard about him before in our investigation. This is John Hay Whitney. Nina was still technically married to Gene Vidal at the time, and she had not yet made her way to Reno for that divorce. Nina Gore and John Hay Whitney had been carrying on an affair for a long time. Nina wanted to marry him. Is it a problem that John Hay Whitney at the time is already married? This was in his first marriage to Liz Whitney Tippett. We know her in our Dun and Dun investigation as Liz Ultimus. Jock Whitney will not marry Nina Gore Vidal. He will go on, Jock Whitney will, though, in 1942, to marry Babe Paley's sister, Betsy Cushing. This is after Betsy's divorce from James Roosevelt, the son of the president. It really does all connect, my friends. So let me back this up just to clarify. Nina is in love with Jock Whitney. They're having an affair. Jock Whitney is married to Liz. Liz isn't too worried about Jock and Nina's affair because Liz is having an affair with Nina's husband, Gene Vidal. It's like a big old rectangle. Gene Vidal was expected to marry Liz, and Nina was going to marry Jock Whitney, so we're just going to do some spouse swapping and make it super easy. It was all going to work out beautifully until Jean Vidal throws a wrench into the works. Gore Vidal wasn't really interested too much in having Hugh D. Auchincloss for a stepfather, and he will tell his mother as much from Gore. Even if I had entirely grasped the necessity of a fortune for the feckless Nina, I don't think that I would have been impressed. If it was to be big money, I preferred Jock's. After we came back from Washington, Nina still expected to marry Mr. John Hay Whitney, while Mrs. John Hay Whitney still expected to marry my father. As it turned out, my father said no to the glamorous Liz, to my sorrow. As a result, Jock said no to Nina, leaving her high, if never entirely dry. Since her father, Senator Thomas Pryor Gore, was facing a difficult primary in Oklahoma and had no money to spare, my mother was obliged to say yes to the persistent Hudie. Nina would be poor no more. Best of all, it was understood from the beginning that there would be no sex. That is the marriage blanc, the white marriage. We're married in name only, but we're not having those kind of relations. Nina Gore Vidal, just like Truman's mother, Lily Mae, who will rename her own self Nina and move to New York in the hopes of finding a wealthy man, Truman's mother, Nina, will with Joe Capote. Nina Gore does the same thing here. Money matters. And Hugh Auchincloss has money. And that Auchincloss family name, which evokes blue bloods and so much high society. A great deal of the Auchincloss family's wealth doesn't come from the Auchincloss family. It comes to the Auchinclosses through marriage. Let's unpack this family just a little bit. It is Hudie Auchincloss's great-uncle, John Winthrop Auchincloss, who originally builds the family's estate, Hammersmith Farm, in Newport, Rhode Island. Hammersmith Farm was built in 1887 and has been there a long, long time. Hammersmith is to the west of Bellevue Avenue, still in Newport, but further out than those grand mansions of Bellevue Avenue that we've talked about before. Hammersmith Farm was a real working farm. It was on November the 19th, 1891, that Hugh Dudley Auchincloss Sr., this is Hudie's father, marries Standard Oil heiress Emma Brewster Jennings. We have skipped around Standard Oil families all the time. Let me connect this one in for you. Emma Brewster Jennings, bride of Hugh D. Auchincloss. Her father is Oliver Burr Jennings. Emma's mother, Esther Judson Goodsell, has a sister. And that sister is married to William Avery Rockefeller. So it is through this connection by marriage that Oliver Burr Jennings gets into the Rockefeller family. Everybody's tight, everybody's cool. And essentially it breaks down like this. In 1871, Standard Oil was incorporated. We have a few original stockholders here, names we've heard before, that are all going to make a pile. Out of the initial 10,000 shares of Standard Oil, John D. Rockefeller gets the most. He gets 2,667, a little over 25%. We're going to divide that 2,667 in half. Three men will collect 1,333 shares. Those three men, William Rockefeller, Henry Flagler, and Samuel Andrews. There's another fella, Stephen V. Harkness. He will get 1,334 shares. Coming a little bit down the line into the Harkness family through marriage for all my Swifties is Rebecca Harkness, she of the last great American dynasty. Rebecca's story is coming on Done and Done, but again, make note of those names. There is another 1,000 shares that goes to Oliver Burr Jennings, which will fold down to his children, including Emma Brewster, and her Standard Oil money is folded into the Auchincloss family when she marries Hugh Sr. That Standard Oil money, y'all, takes the Auchincloss family to the next level of high society and riches. It's definitely a step up. You often hear about, oh, Auchincloss is Standard Oil money. The Auchincloss has Standard Oil money because of marriage through Emma Brewster Jennings. Together, Emma and Hugh Sr., they have three kids, including Hugh D. Auchincloss II, Hughie, who was born August 29, 1897. This year, 1897, is also when Hugh Sr.'s brother John sells Hammersmith Farm to Hugh Sr. and Emma for the family. Hughie has got quite a great pedigree, all the right schools, all the right connections. Hughie attends Groton School before going to Yale and eventually getting his law degree from Columbia. Hughie will practice law in New York City for a few years before starting his own investment and brokerage firm with money from his mother, Emma Brewster Jennings. Hugh, again, as mentioned, does have a first marriage beginning in 1925, ending in 1932, being very available by 1935 for Nina Gore when Jock Whitney doesn't marry her. Everybody take a breath. Was that a lot? Nina doesn't marry Hughie for love purposes necessarily. Nina marries Hughie for money. For that Auchincloss Standard Oil combined fortune. Nina gets her money, but this also would not be a marriage blanc. According to Gore Vidal, Hugh Auchincloss does not hold up his end of that white marriage bargain. Gore recalls finding his mother sitting on the landing early in the morning the day after her wedding to Hughie. Gore knew something was wrong, but he wasn't sure what it was. He will write, "Years later, Nina told me that the white marriage she had agreed to had turned very black indeed the first night. I should note that the only advantage for a child in having an alcoholic parent is that you acquire prematurely quite a bit of valuable data. Apparently, there was going to be sex whether Nina liked it or not. She did not like it, but then no woman could have liked Hughie's importunate fumblings. He ejaculated normally, but without that precedent erection which women require, as if nothing else, totemic symbol of a man's true love, not to mention a homely source of hedonistic friction. Since Hughie wanted more children, Nina was obliged in some fashion. I think she inserted, with a spoon, what she called the bugs in order to create my demi-siblings. It's not hard to imagine why that marriage didn't last. And this time Nina is not going to wait 13 years before getting her divorce. It's only going to turn out to be 5 years this time, as in 1940, Nina leaves Hughie Auchincloss in order to marry her lover, General Robert Olds, who would go on to become Nina's third husband. When Hughie's mother discovered that Nina had left Hughie, she gets involved. Emma begs Nina to stay and offers to increase the money Nina was given. Emma acknowledges her son's sexual problems, which, according to Gore Vidal, Emma attributed to excessive masturbation in youth. But Nina had made up her mind. In September of 1941, Nina was back in Reno, Nevada, looking to get a divorce from her second husband, Hugh D. Auchincloss II. But hey, Nina isn't leaving Hughie high and dry. She's not completely heartless. Nina has helpfully orchestrated Hughie's next marriage for him. It turns out that Nina had met a saleswoman in New York City. She was working in a department store, this lady, and bless her, she had a really nasty divorce under her belt and two young daughters to support, and certainly Hugh's money would come in handy for this nice lady. And arrangements can be made. Who is this woman? You've already guessed, probably, Janet Leigh Bouvier. Janet Leigh Bouvier. Let's take another quick break here, and when we come back, we are going to flip the script over to Lee Radziwill's mother, Janet, and give her a moment in the spotlight in this Mothers of an episode. See you on the flip. Oh, this story's really getting good now, right, investigators? So, Janet Leigh Bouvier. Nina's watching out for Janet, or is she? Now, Janet has not had it easy up to this point, Janet Norton Leigh. Let's unpack her story a little bit. Janet was born December 3rd, 1907 in Manhattan. She's the middle daughter of a real estate developer, and Janet has a pretty good life. All the right credentials, absolutely the right resume. Janet will attend Spence School and go on to attend college at both Sweetbriar and Barnard. Not graduating, though, when in 1928, as Janet is almost ready to graduate, she's 22, who needs a degree when you land a wealthy, dashing, and handsome older man as your husband? At least this is what Janet thinks when it begins. Who is Janet's groom? His given name was John Vernou Bouvier III. He is known often in history by his nickname Black Jack Bouvier. Janet is 22. Black Jack is 37. Black Jack Bouvier is the oldest of five kids, also born in Manhattan on May 19, 1891. Black Jack attends all the best schools. He goes to Philip Exeter and Columbia Prep, then on to Columbia College, then to Yale. His secret society at Yale was the Book and Snake, and Black Jack will graduate from Yale University in 1914. Black Jack Bouvier goes on to be a Wall Street broker, and he has a lot of thoughts. He got a lot of big, big ideas about himself. Black Jack says he can trace his lineage to French soldiers fighting in the Revolutionary War. And Black Jack, if you can imagine, he looks a lot like Clark Gable. He is black-haired. He's very dashing. Black Jack, so you know, is also an early proponent of the sun lamp. He likes to be tan. In addition to his nickname of Black Jack Bouvier, is also sometimes called Jack the Sheik, Jack the Sheik, because of that penchant for the tanning lamp. Also, his really outlandish lifestyle. Think Errol Flynn in the early days. Swashbuckling pirate, wide lapel suits, paisley ties. Black Jack's ride is a Black Mercury convertible. He's a regular at 21. He's a regular at Madison Square boxing matches. There are daily cocktails at the Racquet Club. Black Jack has a real great life on paper. It sounds pretty perfect. Before we get Black Jack married to Janet, I do want to connect in Black Jack's sister into our storyline. Her name is Edith. Edith will go on to marry Phelan Beale in 1917. We know Edith in history as Big Edie. I want to bring in a few gossamer threads of connections and stitch them together for you. Yes, that Big Edie, mother of Little Edie, Big and Little Edie of Grey Gardens fame, all in the same Bouvier family. Before Big Edie married Phelan Beale, she was engaged, first engagement. This was in 1916 to a fellow named Horace Bigelow Allen. Edie and Horace do not get married. Their engagement is broken, leaving Edie to marry Phelan, who was a lawyer and financier who worked at Edie's father's firm. That's great. I mean, it's not great because their marriage is terrible, but that's not the story I need you to know here. The broken engagement boy, Horace. Horace is going to go, after the broken engagement, over to France. He's going to assist the Red Cross in World War I. And Horace is going to fall in love again. Horace marries a British socialite named Kiki Gwen in 1919. I bring this into our story as it is going to come back around. Kiki Gwynn will divorce Horace in 1925. Their marriage lasts about 6 years. Kiki Gwynn remarries an investment banker. His name is Jerome Preston. Kiki Gwynn, Kiki Preston, you'll hear her name. She is an essential part of what is called the Happy Valley set. We haven't really even begun to dip into that one, but Kiki has many love affairs. She also uses a lot of drugs. Kiki's name, her nickname, is the girl with the silver syringe. Kiki, in the Happy Valley set, does take on another lover. This time, her lover is Prince George, Duke of Kent. Prince George, Duke of Kent, is the fourth son of King George V, and Kiki Gwynn will bear, perhaps, the illegitimate son of Prince George. That is what Prince George's brother, Edward VIII, thinks anyway. This boy was adopted in infancy by Cass and Catherine Canfield. The boy's name is Michael, Michael Canfield. Michael Canfield will be the very first of the husbands of Gore's stepsister, Lee Radziwill. We're going to talk about all of that drama more in the next episode, as we need to get to Janet Lee and Blackjack getting married to have their two daughters. But y'all, really, the threads, the connections, mind-blowing. Back to our story. So Janet thinks early in life, young, early 20s, that Blackjack looks like a great choice. He has all the right credentials, so handsome, so dashing, so suave, loaded with cash. But the thing that I also need you to know is Janet doesn't know this. Blackjack is a liar. Blackjack will tell Janet his family is loaded with cash, which is not entirely true. There is no hidden fabulous wealth in the Bouvier family, not the kind that Janet was expecting to find and wanted to find in her heart. I need you to know that money is always important to Janet. Always has been, always will be, money motivated. Similarly to Nina Gore. Janet Norton Lee, before she marries Blackjack, I'm going to presume was sweet and nice and all things good. But Janet is not going to stay that way after being married to the cad, the scoundrel, Blackjack Bouvier. You're going to hear a lot about Janet in our coming story and how her character develops as the years go on. The experiences that we all go through form us. I don't necessarily think they formed Janet for the better. As we're going to find out next week, she passes a lot of stuff on to her daughters. Once Janet and Blackjack do marry, again, 1928, Janet becomes aware of two things almost immediately. The first, there's no family money. And once the Depression hits, remember they marry in 28, the Depression comes along in 1929, and whatever modest fortune the Bouvier family has possessed is now wiped out. More problematically, the second problem that Janet discovers is that her new husband, Blackjack, is an alcoholic, and a violent alcoholic at that. Blackjack will physically abuse Janet, who honestly will give back as much as she gets. Janet is known to throw plates and household objects and hurl curses right back at her husband. It is a volatile marriage from the beginning all the way through to the end. Janet and Blackjack in their marriage will have two daughters. The first, Jacqueline, in 1929. The second, Caroline Lee, in 1933. The childhood that these two girls have in youth is not ideal. To add insult to injury, besides the alcohol abuse and the violence, Blackjack is also a notorious philanderer. Doesn't even try to hide it. There's no on the DL. It is just right out there in the open. So right out there in the open that Blackjack, if y'all can imagine this, is famously photographed holding his mistress's hand while posing in this picture with his wife Janet on the other side. There's Blackjack holding the hand of his mistress, and Janet's in the picture too. This photo lands on front pages everywhere. Janet, as you can imagine, is humiliated. She's finally had enough. Janet and Blackjack will separate in 1936 after about 8 years of marriage. They will finally divorce in 1940 when Nina Gore, on her way to divorce from Hugh D. Auchincloss, kindly hooks that nice sales lady up, Janet, with her soon-to-be ex. Gore Vidal describes Janet as a financially desperate social climber with two small daughters to raise. Janet was eager to marry someone just like poor Hudy, which Nina suggested she did. Now, Gore Vidal and Janet Lee Bouvier, soon to be Auchincloss, never, ever, ever get along. To be fair, Gore despises both his mother and his quasi-stepmother Janet, but Gore makes a really astute statement here about the differences between the two women. Gore will say the essential difference between Nina and Janet was that Janet made trouble. Nina was trouble. Kind of think about that. Gore Vidal, bless his little heart, will go on to point out how much his mother's decision, Nina's decision to leave Hudy, may have actually impacted history. Gore writes about his new stepsister, Jackie. Jackie, constantly presented as a wealthy debutante of the highest society, was, like me, a poor connection of the Auchinclosses. Had it not been for Nina's exasperation with Hudy, Nina's candidate for replacement, Janet could have never taken her place at Marywood and Newport, Rhode Island. I have often wondered what would have become of Jackie had Nina stayed with Hudy. Jackie would certainly have married money. That is to be taken for granted. But she would have never got Jack. One shudders to think that there would have never been a Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis if Hudy could have had a satisfactory erection. Janet and Hugh D. Auchincloss will marry on June 21st, 1942. The couple marries at Marywood, Hugh D.'s home. In Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lives of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters by J. Randy Taraborelli, he writes of Janet's marriage to Hudy. On the whole, she was content, even though as a young woman of 34, she had made certain sacrifices in marrying Hugh, not the least of which had been forfeiting the kind of passion she once shared with her first husband, Jack Bouvier. However, she was a pragmatic woman who, once she made a choice in life, made an effort never to look back. Taraborelli has a different version of how Janet and Hugh met, but will agree with the issue of Auchincloss's sexual issues. Taraborelli writes that Janet was concerned about Hugh's attraction to her and lack of spark between them, so she decided, Janet did, to ask Hudy what his intentions toward her were. Quote, he was honest with her. He sadly confessed that he was chronically impotent and said this had been the case for many years. He said it was why his second marriage to Nina ended. Because he felt it only fair to her, he wanted to be quite clear with Janet. The two of them would not have a sexual relationship. He had accepted this painful, unfortunate limitation in himself long ago and said he was too old to try to hide it or act as if it wasn't the case. What's Janet's trade-off here? Janet wants the stability and power of being Hudy's wife more than she wanted an active sex life. So Janet agrees that Hudy's impotence was a problem that she could deal with. Janet will invite her parents to Marywood when she does this for the first time. Janet will bask in the glory of showing off her new home, since her parents all the way back had disapproved of her marriage to Blackjack in the first place, and they shamed her constantly when she was married to him when Janet asked her parents for help with money, not just to survive, but to keep up her lifestyle. After going on a tour of Merriwood, its expansive grounds, and the home, Janet's father will say to her that he imagined that Janet would no longer need to ask him for money, and Janet could agree. Then, Janet's dad looks directly at his daughter and says, "You may have money now, but not power. You don't have power. Don't forget that." Oh, but Janet, strong and determined, she is not going to let her father get the last word. Janet reaches over and holds her new husband, Hudie's hand, and stares at her father and says, "Yes, but Hudie has it. Therefore, so do I." Janet is going to wield the power and the money of this new marriage for sure. Janet is able now to provide quite a better life for her two daughters, Jacqueline and Lee, including the best schools and horses and all the things that go along with that life of privilege. Money and power are essential to Janet. Janet will remain married to Hugh Auchincloss until his death in 1976. Janet and Hudie, surprisingly, do not have a marriage blanc either, just like Hudie and Nina. Janet and Hugh in their marriage will go on to have two children together, perhaps surprisingly, but make what you will of it. Janet Bouvier Auchincloss and Hugh Auchincloss work great on paper. That also explains for you investigators how Gore and Lee and Jackie are all step-related, as the family ties mean something then and through time into the future. That is the briefest I can give you on the mothers in play here. Again, Truman Capote and Gore Vidal, their mothers are not that dissimilar. I'm going to need you to remember that when we get around to their relationship in the feud episode. Janet Lee Bouvier is her own piece of work that we will explore a bit more when we pick up next time, taking a deeper dive into Lee Radziwill's story. I want to bring Lee into full focus in our investigation. We did not cover Lee back within our Capote's Coterie series, and it is high time to remedy that. Lee is quite a complex character with her own motivations, ones that we do not see in the feud series. I do hope you join me next time to get into Lee's story, part of which is crucial to understanding that bitter rivalry and feud between Truman and Gore. Oh, friends, the spiderwebs are many and ever so connected. Thank you for tuning in and telling your friends about Done and Done, for your kind reviews and your emails, for your support over on Patreon, too. $2 a month will get you in early and ad-free on every main feed episode. $5 a month will add all those main feed episodes, along with 87 that are currently posted. Our man Nick really does provide his own universe, and it is my joy and pleasure to explore it here on Done and Done. Thanks again for joining me. I can't wait to see you next time for the story of Lee Radziwill. Until we meet again then, stay curious and keep on investigating. Thanks for listening to the Done and Done podcast, a Hemlock Creatives production. You can email us at doneanddone@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram at Done and Done Podcast. For further information about our episodes or sources, you can find us online at www.doneanddone.com. See you next week, friends.